Let's go ahead and pray together before we look at the Word. Lord, I thank You for Your Word that You've given to us. Lord, I thank You for the gift of Your Spirit that speaks to us. Lord, I thank You for the purposes that You have in opening our eyes to it, and I would ask that our eyes would be open, that we'd be alert, that we'd be listening. Lord, I would ask that You would also be with me, that I would speak what You want spoken and even think what You want thought. Lord, these are Your sheep, the ones that belong to You, and I would ask that You would bless them with a word from You and Your presence with them today. I pray this in Your name. Amen. Well, we're continuing our look together at the theme called A Desire Realized. It comes from Proverbs chapter 13, verse 19, where it says, "A desire realized is sweet to the soul, but it's an abomination to fools to turn away from evil." And as we're looking at that, what I'm trying to say and what I want you to understand is that as God gives us dreams, aspirations, desires, plans, whatever it is, as He gives us those things, and as we respond to Him and work with Him through those desires, that He's actually shaping our soul. That's what He uses to shape who we are and how we think and what we were going to become. And you know, I want to mention again that it's not always the big dreams and the big desires. We're looking at the characters in the Bible, the people in the Bible who were doing some big things, like building a 500-foot yacht for the flood that was going to come. Some big things like being the king of a nation, some big things like that. But as we look at God's Word, and we'll find that even next week, and that there's some small things, some relatively small things, that is, on the grand scheme of things, it's not something that would get in the history books, but it's something that God has for us that He wants us to do. It could be something small. It could be like the Lord speaks to your heart and says, "I'd like you to start reading in a certain place in the Bible," or "I'd like you to read through the Bible in a year," or "I want you to memorize some verses, let's say one a week, all right, one a month," whatever it is. And He says, "This is what I want you to do." Or He brings to your mind, "I want you to begin praying in a certain way for certain people," or "I want you to speak to certain people." Or it could be that He has something that He wants to speak to you about your time and a plan that He has for you to go do something or to minister in a certain way or to volunteer somewhere, and those, that's what He's talking to you about. It could be that He has something that He wants you to do with the money that He's given you, and He says, "This is what I would like for you to do, where I would like for you to invest." There's a lot of things that God talks to us about. And He says, over the next month, or over the next 6 months, or over the next year, this is where I want you to work. This is what I want you to do. A desire realized is sweet to the soul. But what we're going to find out, or what we've already found out, is that whenever it's something that God gives us, something that God says, "This is what I want you to do," for somebody else it would be small, not that big of a deal. But for us it's big. Because it begins to shape our soul. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, just as soon as we begin going down this track of what God wants us to do, there's voices on the outside that say, "Well, that's a dumb thing to do," or "You don't have time for that," or "You don't have money for that," or "Let somebody younger do that," or "Let somebody older do that," or whatever it is. There's somebody who will correct you in their great wisdom and explain what it is that you should do. And then last week we talked about the voices that are in our own head. That was the problem with King Saul, is in his own mind, even though he was already king, he was still small in his own eyes. And all of the decisions that he made were based on what he was hearing, not what somebody else was saying, but what he was hearing in his own mind. Well, today we're going to get practical, a little more practical. I have a phrase that I like to say. I don't know if I heard it from somebody else, but I'll claim it until somebody can bring up the footnote that says it. You know, there's a difference between a fantasy and a dream. A fantasy is something you talk about. A dream is something you work towards. A fantasy is something that you talk all about, and this is something you're going to do someday, but a dream is something where you get very specific and start doing something about it, writing it down, scheduling it, doing what your dream is. That's the difference between a fantasy and a dream. There's another phrase that I know that you've heard, and that is that the devil is in the details. I like to change that and say God is in the details. And that is a fact, though. That once we move from fantasy to dream, once we move from talking about it to planning about it, you find out that the details get a little sticky. And the details is where we meet God. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, because Nehemiah has a dream, but then he gets into the details. I want you to see that the pursuit of a dream is always going to cost you something. That's the difference between a fantasy and a dream. A fantasy, you can daydream all day long and it doesn't cost you a thing. I think that's why movies and books and stuff like that are so popular. You know, they're the escape. Let's go watch somebody else fulfill their dream. Let's go read about somebody else fulfilling their dream. Let's go streaming Netflix for the next 5 hours so that we don't have to go out and mow the lawn. You know, that's where reality is. It's all right to escape, but a dream is going to cost you something real. And the soul is shaped by the decision you make to pay the cost. That's the way it is. I'd like to read, and I'm going to be reading for a long time. Just letting you know ahead of time. Well, I think I'm ahead of myself. I want to talk about some history first. Just sounds like I'm trying to put you to sleep. I'm going to talk about history, and then I'm going to read for a long, long time. I hope it's, you know, hope there's some interest here. Nehemiah is the practical cost of the dream. Here's the history. I'll go through it really quick, just the historical background. It's there on your paper. In 598, 100 years after Isaiah said it's going to happen, Judah was taken away into exile. One of the most fascinating books in the Bible for me is Isaiah. Because you have Isaiah saying 100 years, 700 years before it happens, what happens? If that isn't proof that God was speaking, I don't know what is. But 100 years after Isaiah, Judah is taken away into exile. After that, in 538 BC, Zerubbabel, who is a prince, but he's not sent back as a king, he's sent back as a governor eventually, takes some of the exiles back from Babylon, and they begin to rebuild the temple just a couple of years later, 536 BC. And as they're rebuilding the temple, they get discouraged and they want to quit. And so you have the prophets Haggai and Zechariah in 520 BC about that time. As you read their books, what they're talking about is they're trying to encourage the people. Come on, keep building, keep building. And so finally in 515 BC, the temple is completed. And if you're reading Jewish history, you're going to find out that they put the date of the exile from 598 to 515. Some will start in 520 or whenever they start going back. But when they rededicate the temple, exile's over. They're starting over. But then about 60 years goes by, and when we come to Ezra and Nehemiah, nothing much has happened. The walls are torn down. Nothing much is happening in the order of worship. They've got the temple. They've got the city. But they're not a nation yet. Now let's look at Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital of Persia, the Persians have taken over, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Here's Nehemiah living a comfortable life with a very responsible position. He's the cupbearer to the king. He has a good salary, good job, good place to live, very comfortable. And then the relatives come to visit. And the relatives tell him all about all the bad things that are happening back home. Now, part of having a dream or a desire and pursuing a dreamer that God has given you is, how do you know it's His voice? And we've been talking about that on Wednesdays. And if you're interested in hearing more about that, I'd encourage you to come on Wednesdays at 6 o'clock. And how do you hear the voice of God? We're talking about that. But one of the ways that you hear God is that there's just a burden. You see something, and something inside of you says, that needs to change. It may be not an audible voice. It's not something from the Word necessarily that stands out to you as you look at it, but you're looking at it and there's this deep set of, that's not right. I need to fix it. And that's what happens with Nehemiah. He hears the relatives come and say, well, he says, how's everything in Jerusalem? Well, it's bad. Everybody's poor. Everybody's struggling. The walls are down, which means there's no defenses. There's no leadership. Things are not going well. And he cries. And then he begins to pray. He says, I beseech you, O Lord, verse 5, God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love Him and keep His commandments, let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I'm praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We've acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. He goes all the way back to Deuteronomy. And in one of the discouraging sermons in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses says to the people of Israel, as they're going about to go into the promised land, he says, you're going to turn away and you're going to go into exile. How's that for a prophecy? You're hard-headed, he says. You're not heads. And we've been, for 40 years, we've been wandering around and you still haven't got it and you're going to go away. But when you come back, God will hear you. Several hundred years later, Jeremiah says the same thing. Jeremiah is after Isaiah. Isaiah said it, and Jeremiah says, you're going into exile. But when you're there, you're going to hear me, and you're going to search for me. And when you start searching for me, you're going to find me. And so Nehemiah is taking his Bible. He's taking Moses, and he's taking Jeremiah, and he's saying, this is what you said, God. Remember the word which you commanded, verse 8, your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. And it happened. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. There are your servants. They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. Well, what is he saying? He said, Lord, they still belong to you. Even though they're hard-headed, even though you've scattered them, even though times are rough, they belong to you. I was reading this week in Psalm 77 and Psalm 78. On Wednesdays, like I said, we've been talking about how does God speak to you. And when we were trying to decide whether or not I would be a pastor after we left the mission field, and we were reading and saying, Lord, now what do we do? came to Psalm 77. At the end of Psalm 77, it talks about how Moses and Aaron led them like they were a flock. And then chapter 78, it's at the end of it, it says, "And then you gave them David, and he shepherded them like a flock." And those are two psalms that the Lord spoke to my heart, and he said, "These are your people. These are my people," God said. "These are your flock, and I want you to shepherd them." That's what Nehemiah is saying. That's where the burden in his heart is. He looks out and he says, "These people belong to you. They're yours. Oh Lord." Verse 11. Well, verse 10. "They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. Oh Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name. And make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man." What man? The king. He's got to keep working. That's one of the uncomfortable things about when God speaks to you, is that you still have to get up and go do what you're supposed to do. You know, if you're working, you go to work. If you're not working, you still have to take care, you still have to mow the lawn. I don't know why that's so much on my head today. It's just there's things you still have to go about and do. You still have to pay your bills. You still have to weed the garden, whatever. You have to do it. He's the cupbearer to the king. "Lord, today, as I go about my business, speak." And it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. "And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence." That's a dangerous thing, to be sad in the presence of the king. That's not your job. Your job is to be happy. Your job is to drink his wine, taste his food. Everything's fine. Don't be sad. "So the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart.' Then I was very much afraid. And I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate, and its gates have been consumed by fire?' And then the king said to me, 'What would you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven." I want you to notice that. We think of God speaking in those times when we've gone up in the mountain and we're alone for weeks and weeks or days and days or however long we can afford. And we sit there and we have our quiet times of prayer and note-taking, and that's important. We think that God speaks on a Sunday morning when the preacher's preaching, and that's important. But notice his prayer as he's going about doing whatever it is he does. He sends a quick prayer. I like it this morning in our times of prayer with the guys. We were reading in Psalm 55, verse 22, where it says, "Cast your cares on him, for he cares for you." And you might remember that a while back I made that an acrostic, you know, the cast. C, call it what it is. A, acknowledge you need him for this particular situation. S, submit. I'm going to do whatever you say. T, thank him because he speaks to you and he's shown you what to do. So that cast, and when I grew up casting, I found out that this isn't the way real Coloradans are supposed to do it. You're not supposed to put a worm on the end of the hook and throw it in and sit there and wait. I was told this by a real Coloradan this week. He said, "Real people from Colorado fly fish because only the tourist and the lazy people just sit there like that." I thought, wow. I won't tell you who said it. There's some truth to that, you know. With God, casting isn't just throw it out there. It's fly fishing. Because it keeps coming back. You have to keep on casting it to the Lord, casting it to the Lord, casting it to the Lord. And that's what he does. Nehemiah, what's the matter with you? Oh Lord, help me now. He cast it at him. I prayed to you in chapter 10, verse 11, or chapter 1, verse 11. Lord, give me a good rapport with the king today. And I don't know, maybe Nehemiah didn't really expect the king to say anything, but he goes in and the king says something, and so he has to say another quick prayer. Lord, help! So verse 5, I said to the king, if it please the king and your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. He voices his dream, his prayer. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will the journey be? When will you return? So it pleased the king to send me. And I gave him a definite time. I don't know what his time frame was. It doesn't say. It's going to take a while to build the wall. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces before the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me, because the good hand of my God was on me. And then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. And now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. Then Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it. It was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the nations of Israel. So he finally comes to Jerusalem, and there he was for 3 days. I wonder what he's doing for 3 days. Jet lag? I guess that doesn't happen on donkeys. I don't know. You know, it's one thing to have a dream and a vision and a desire. It's another thing to get there and look at it and go, oh my goodness. It's kind of like when we moved into our house and first thing is the washing machine overflowed and filled up the laundry room with water. And I wanted to call the landlord and tell him to come and fix it. And lo and behold, that was me. It's one thing to desire something and plan for something and go for something, and then you get there. And you go, not so sure I wanted this. So, verse 12, and I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I didn't tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out by night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and on the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates which were consumed by fire. And then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. And then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials didn't know where I had gone or what I had done, or yet had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. And then I said to them, it's time to put the dream in action. He wanders around, and for 70 years, give or take, depending on which exile you're talking about, and when Nebuchadnezzar finally destroyed Jerusalem, the walls are just the way they've always been. They're still burned down. They're still broken down. The weeds have come up. It's a mess. A dream is going to have a practical cost. If a dream moves from a fantasy to a dream, it's going to cost something. First of all, he had to know what he wanted to do. You find this in chapter 2, verse 5. King Artaxerxes says, what do you want to do? I want to go back and build the city of my people. How long are you going to be there? He gives him a time. And by the way, would you give me a passport? And would you give me a visa? And would you give me permission so that I can go through these various places and the kings don't challenge me along the way. And by the way, I'm going to need materials. And notice that he gets the materials even before he leaves. And he's carrying them with him. And as he's going along and he says, I'm going to need this many 2x4s, and I'm going to need this much sheetrock, and I'm going to need this much, well, whatever they build walls with back then, rocks and beams and so forth. And then he says, and by the way, I'm going to need a building permit. That's what it says in chapter 2, verse 9. He's very practical. And I want you to notice that he has all of these details before he talks to the king. As he has been praying and as he's been thinking and as he's been worrying and he's been all of that and bringing it before the Lord, somehow, now he's an administrator. He's a good administrator. The Lord has been talking to him and he says, well, what's it going to take? Well, I'm going to need, if I'm going to build this city, it's going to take a while. I don't know if he had building experience or not. He had administration experience. Did he talk to some other people and say, what does it take to build a wall? Did he go to the library and get the books on building a wall? I don't know. But he gets it all. He gets the logistics down. How many 2x4s? How many cinder blocks? How many? All of that. And it's ready. You know, a dream is going to have a practical cost. I mentioned this to you a couple of weeks before, but you know that mountain I wanted to climb, Gunung Merbabu, as I would look at it every time. And I knew that it was 10,120 some odd feet high. And I knew I'd never climbed anything like that. And so when we were living out in East Java, I found that hill outside of where we lived that was the tourist spot. Do you remember how many steps there were to the top? 414. 414, and to climb up and down and up and down. You see, to climb Gunung Merbabu was going to require 7 hours of stair-stepper experience. And you just don't decide you're going to do that and show up. Because if you do, you get started and you get tired and you quit and you go back down. That's what he's talking about. When he's talking about a dream, he's saying you're going to have to get out your day timer and look at the calendar and say, this is what I'm going to block out this time and this is what I'm going to do. When he says you have a dream, he says you're going to have to get out your checkbook. You're going to get out your check register. I assume that you all still use those. Now, some people don't. My son says he just does it all online. I don't trust it. So I tell Sherry, look it up. I want to print out. I want to see it. Get out the checkbook. Whatever the dream is, you're going to have to get out your exercise log. And you're going to check it off. And you're going to, you know, a fantasy will excuse the fact that you only went to the gym one day this week. But you're a regular attender. Kind of like church. Sorry. You know, I love the Lord. How often do you attend? Oh, every week or every other week or something like, you know, if we check it off. It's kind of like, well, I'm going to lose 5 pounds. Well, you got to get out your calorie counter and see, well, I forgot I ate that. I do. You know, I've started writing things down. That's the practical, that's what he's talking about. Whatever it is, he says, this is what I want to do. And the question is, what is it going to cost? And one of the reasons this is so important is because once you start seeing that, it's like showing up at Jerusalem and seeing 70 years worth of rubble. That's when the voices start. Sanballat and Tobiah. Or the people who came with you on the journey and you get there. And you notice how he said, he hadn't told anybody exactly what he was going to do. One of the reasons he hadn't told anybody exactly what he wanted to do is because he needed to settle it in his heart before he opened his mouth. Because they were going to say, you want to do what? And they did. God's dreams, small or big, have some details. And it's in the details that we begin hearing the voices. And if you are not ready to hear the voices, you're just going to say, well, that's too much. But God-sized dreams have a cost that you cannot pay. I want to remind you of the difference between Proverbs 13:12 and Proverbs 13:19. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The difference between Proverbs 13:12 and Proverbs 13:19 is in Proverbs 13:12, it's just the way the world works. It's the way humans work. It's the way God set things up. That's the way it is. It's talking about people who just talk and their hope is deferred. In other words, it doesn't happen, and so their heart gets sick because they were just talking. And then there's the people who, it talks about a tree of life, the ones who actually make a plan and work the plan, and they do it just like the way a tree grows or the way a building grows. And so it's fun to see the project come to reality. That's the way it is for everybody. But chapter 13, verse 19 is talking about the soul and evil. And the dreams that God gives is going to affect us in a way that doesn't affect anybody else. Somebody else would look at it and say, what's your problem? That's easy. Just go plan it and do it. But God gives you a dream because it's going to shape your soul, or it's going to challenge your soul. It's going to challenge who you are. Like me climbing that mountain. Anybody could climb that mountain. A lot of people climbed that mountain, but it was a challenge to me, not just physically, but spiritually, because of some voices in the head that needed to be challenged. And God-sized dreams are going to have a cost that you cannot pay. Nehemiah could not achieve his own dream apart from God's intervention. Now that's just a fact. Chapter 1, verse 11, chapter 2, verse 4, those times when he prays, says, Lord, give me favor in the eyes of the king. Nehemiah didn't have enough money to build the walls. Nehemiah had a job, and you don't just walk away from the king and say, see you, I'm going to go down here and take about a year or two off and go build this wall. He had to have permission, official permission from the king. It wasn't going to happen just because he wanted it to happen. And that's the way it is with any dream that God gives us. Something is going to change because God changes it, not because we are so smart or so strong or so rich or whatever. And it can be something simple. But that's, he couldn't do it on his own. But more than that, he, Nehemiah, could not foresee or achieve God's bigger goal apart from God. I've used this phrase several times when we were looking at 1 Corinthians. This bigger goal that God has. You know, we just look down here and this is our little dream that we have. But he has a bigger goal than we do. His bigger goal is that our hearts would be shaped, but even more so than that, that people's lives would be changed. And the bigger goal for Nehemiah, that Nehemiah had no idea, was what God was up to. Today, he's known as the father of Judaism. Nehemiah and Ezra, the father of Judaism. What God was accomplishing through the exile, and what God was accomplishing through the return, and the building, and what God was accomplishing through Nehemiah and through Ezra, established the nation Israel in a way that it had never been established before. It had never been the kind of nation we have in our mind, the nation Israel, as it is even today, but as it was certainly then. Moses didn't have that kind of a nation. He had all these people following him, and Joshua for a while, and they start taking things over, but Judges, the book of Judges comes. And at the end of the book of Judges, it says, every man did what was right in his own eyes. They were a people, they were tribes, and they had the word, but they were scattered in their minds, which is why God eventually scattered them physically. And when he brought them back, what God was doing through Nehemiah and Ezra and Haggai and Zechariah, but mainly through Nehemiah, was bringing them back together, building a physical wall. But read the rest of the book. I don't have time to read all the rest of the book today. And he is helping them formulate themselves into a people. They have the synagogue. Through Ezra, they have the word. They have the temple reestablished. And it is during this time of exile that they become the Jews, a solid nation. So that even when they're destroyed once again in 70 AD, they're enough of a people that they last until 1949 and will last because of what God was doing in that time. Did Nehemiah have any idea that that's what God was doing? No. God's dream, or Nehemiah's dream, was to build the wall. His heart is broken for his people. He wants to make them a nation once again. He wants to build the city once again. He wants to make them the Israelites once again. He doesn't want to hear from his relatives that everything's trashed and falling apart in Jerusalem. That's what he's thinking. God is thinking, what I'm going to do now will affect these people for the next several thousand years. And you know, when God gives you a dream or a vision, even if the dream or the vision is something small, like I'm going to take the folder that we have with everybody's name, the directory, I'm going to pray through it once a week. What he does in you is one thing. You have no idea what he's going to do in a church that you pray for and know their names and remember their birthdays and remember their anniversaries. That's a goal. I'm not giving that to you. I'm saying if God did that, you have no... For you, it does something, but what is he going to do? What is he going to do if he gives you a dream or a vision to start walking through your neighborhood and praying for the people and sharing your faith with the ones that he brings and says, talk to them? He has a bigger goal. It'll do something in you. It'll do something bigger in his economy. And you can't do that. That's not you. That's why you want to get on board with whatever God is doing, at whatever age you are. Because the ability to see what isn't there yet is the very character of God. And He wants to share that with you. That's what dreams are, to see what isn't there yet. But that's God's business. But you are going to have to pay something. Okay. You know, we have this idea, you know, and I understand grace is free. I do understand that. But I've heard this so many times, and it's just not right. We want people to pray the prayer so that they can get to heaven. I don't see anywhere in the Bible where he talks about praying a prayer so you can get to heaven. He talks about making a decision to follow Christ, and that affects the rest of your life. So those verses that were read a few minutes ago from Luke, talking about making a commitment to take up your cross and follow Him. And he says, you don't go start a building project without figuring out how much cement you're going to need and how many bolts you're going to need and how many beams you're going to need and how much shingle. You don't start a project like that, or you get halfway through and you don't have the money to finish it and everybody says, you didn't know what you were doing, did you? That's why you hire a contractor. I guess. Or get somebody who knows what they're doing. So he says, if you're going to follow me, count the cost. Because in another place he says, nobody putting the hand to the plow and then looking back and saying, I'm not sure I want to do this, is worthy of the kingdom. You see, it's serious stuff. That's, you know, when Nehemiah is riding around Jerusalem and he's looking at all the walls broken down, he made the decision in Susa, in Persia, that he was going to follow this through. And when he got to Jerusalem and saw it, I don't know, it doesn't say, but I imagine his heart fluttered a bit. But then he said, no, this is a vision that God gave, and I'm going to follow it through. That's the way you follow God. There's things only God can do, but you are going to have to pay. Just mark it down. If you're going to follow the Lord. And what did Nehemiah have to pay? He had to pay time. How long are you going to be gone, Nehemiah? 10 years. He went back But the amount of time between chapter 2 and chapter 13 when he comes back is 10 years. A decade of his life he committed to this particular project. Now I know you're going to read that in just 50 some odd days they built the wall. That's true. But the whole commitment of time to this city was 10 years. He had to pay that. He didn't just sit in Susa doing his job, living in his comfy house, being happy with what he was doing, imagining, fantasizing about Jerusalem becoming a city again. He packed, he left, he worked for 10 years. Money. Chapter 5, you'll read that if you go home and read the rest of the book during this week. It says that all the other governors took pay, but he wouldn't take it because he wanted everybody in Jerusalem to know that he was committed to this project and he used his own funds to live. I wonder if Paul read this in chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians where he says to the Corinthian church, you guys are hard-headed and I won't take any money from you so that I can preach freely and you can't say, well, we're willing to pay your salary. And Paul says, no, you're not. I'm making tents. I think he read this. That's what Nehemiah said. Used his own money. Physically, chapter 4, verse 6, it says we, and so we built the wall. And what does that mean? It means he got his tool belt, he put it on, he went out there, and he was actually helping build the wall. And then this last one I like is the mental and emotional stress. And he didn't sue anybody for it. He had to pay. What's happening in chapter 4? You have Sanballat and Tobiah. They keep on rearing their ugly head. They start in chapter 2, go all the way through. They're trying to stop the project. And in chapter 4, you find out that they're saying horrible things. Oh, you guys don't even know how to build. They must have seen some of my projects. You don't even know how to build. If anybody were to push on this wall, it would fall flat. Chapter 4. And the people got discouraged. You see, that's where the voices are. The voices on the outside and the voices on the inside saying, what do you think you're doing? And so as a manager, if anybody's ever managed anything, and somebody, you know, the underlings, the employees, they always say, well, I wish I had a cushy job like the manager where you don't have to do anything but just tell people what to do. Have you ever managed something? Is there some stress involved? As he's trying to encourage the people and say, let's do this. And so he manages them and he helps them and he says, okay, half of you are going to work and the other half are going to stand guard. And then after a while, okay, even the half that are working, you're going to have a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. Try doing masonry that way. The whole thing, the point is, they work through these voices. It says even though they were afraid. But it cost Nehemiah. How many times did he say in his mind? I don't know. It isn't recorded. You know, back in Susa, all I had to do was taste the wine, taste the food, say it was okay, and hand it to him, and then go home. Duty done. And now I got this. I'm making it up. I don't know. The point is that a dream, you have to pay for it. Why? Why would you do that? What's the benefit of paying the cost of a dream? Why not sit back in an easy chair and stream Netflix and watch somebody else's? Why? I want to read this verse. Verse 31, last verse in the book, chapter 13. The last sentence, not all of it, just the last sentence. Remember me, O God, for good. Remember me, O God, for good. Why is he willing to do it? Well, because of the smile of God. This reminds me, and I'll show you this next one in just a minute, in chapter 25 of Matthew. And it reminds me of Book of Numbers, chapter 6, verse 24 through 26. These two times where he's talking about the smile of God. And Moses says to Aaron, I want you to bless the people in this way. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Three times in that promise it is the face of the Lord. That's what it means to fear the Lord, is have your face on him. And I like especially the second part of that blessing. The Lord shine his face to shine upon you. When you read the Hebrew, that's what it's saying. We translate it into English and we say, the Lord make his face to shine upon you. And it reminds me of Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 16, or I think that's right, where he's talking about how the Lord dances over us. It's not Nehemiah. What is it? Zephaniah, thank you. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 16. The Lord is dancing over you. Numbers chapter 6, verse 25. The Lord shine his face to shine upon you. Matthew chapter 25. Well done, good and faithful servant. What's it worth to hear God and see God look at you and say, good job? Good job. The benefit of staying with the dream. Lord, as he says in Nehemiah, the last verse, remember me for good. I'm doing what you told me to do. I'm doing what you told me to do. And the Lord smiles on him and says, yes, you are. In fact, you're doing more than you have any idea of what's going on. You have no idea, Nehemiah, that you are establishing the nation for 2,000 years. You have no idea. Well, God's doing it through him. The smile of God and the shape of our heart. In Matthew chapter 25, verse 23, you know that story where the manager, the owner, goes away and he gives the talents to the three. What is it? And the first two, they do the job, they double the money. The last one says, nah, I'll just give him back his money when he comes back. And to the first two, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. That phrase, good and faithful, they have proven who they are by what they're doing. And what does he say to the third one, the one that just buried it? You wicked, slothful slave. He has proven by what he has done who he is. The benefit of paying the cost is that it shapes who we are. That's the whole point, at least for us. That our heart would be shaped in his image. Because when it says in Romans chapter 8, verse 29, that we are to be pressed into the image of Christ, you remember the drawing that we had last week, that picture of a diamond that's in the middle of the path? So that every facet becomes a reflection. When God looks at us, he sees the shine of himself. That's what he's looking for. That's the shape of our heart. Nehemiah, the practical cost of a dream. How much time, how many boards, how many passport visas, how many building permits? What's it going to take? The pursuit of dreams always comes at a cost. And the soul is shaped as we make the decision every day to pay. Why? Because we want to see his face smile. Say, good job. Good job. Next week we look at part two, Ruth and Esther, counting the cost. Let's pray together. Lord, we want to see you smile. It's what we were made for, is to see you smile. Lord, we don't want to be wicked and slothful. We want to be good and faithful. Lord, we don't have any idea what you're doing in somebody else through what you do in us. But you are. Lord, help us to be willing to pay what it costs to join you in whatever it is you're doing. I pray this in your name. Amen.